Welcome back. Let's do a quick review. Last time we did pages 321 to 337. Just to kind of give us a macro view, we've had the main chapters of the darkness, the flood, prison, and the Holy Spirit. They've been the main chapters. Now we're on the chapter about the house. The big point in this chapter is that the house, as the house of wisdom, is described by the allusions in the text to texts in the Bible. I won't bother repeating all of what that is. As being connected with the house of God. And the thing which is seen inside the house is the sun and the moon. So the idea is that we have an image here of a new portrayal of what God is. Why is that so important? Because this is the arch theologian of the church, and you can see within him the way the unconscious is portraying the God image in a different fashion. This is part of Jung's idea of the transformation of the God image, that it literally wants to change, and you can see that in the way it appears in dreams. All the more important when it appears in the unconscious material of somebody so devoted to the church. The other point that was very interesting, I thought, was that the sun and the moon as an alchemical image, when they are depicted that way, are stages in a process of union, whereby out of that union a light is produced. The reason she says that is because there's so many alchemical allusions throughout the text. So that gives her, she feels, reason to say this is an alchemical image as well. And then she compares that to the reference to the New Jerusalem in the book of Revelation, where it said that the light in the New Jerusalem isn't from the sun and the moon, but it's from the Lamb. So you've got three stages of, effectively three stages of divine images. One, the sun and the moon as the light. Two, the Lamb as the light. Three, the light begotten of the sun and the moon. So they would be three different phases of our experience of what's divine. The classical one would be the light of the sun and the moon. The Christian one would be the light of the Lamb. And the next one is, in a way, a synthesis of both of those, because the sun and the moon would be nature principles. But it isn't the light of nature that is the light coming in this house. It's the light born of the union of the nature principles. So you've got nature principle in classical antiquity, you've got spirit in Christianity, and in this image you've got a spirit born of nature. And that spirit born of nature, you know, it's what we've been saying all along this book, that the spiritual experience starts at the low level. Does that all sound familiar? I think it's really interesting because you can watch the evolution of the God image. And that's what's behind a lot of our chaos today. That's why people don't go to church. Because in the depths of the psyche, it is felt that the light, which would be the understanding, isn't relevant anymore. They may not articulate it that way, but they just don't feel satisfied. And we see an image here of why they don't feel satisfied. The next big image led to, let me see, Oh, the other thing maybe that we mentioned very briefly was that she compared the light born of the sun and the moon to the sun-moon woman in the apocalypse. And the sun-moon woman in the apocalypse had clothing of the sun and her feet on the moon. So it's the very same idea. The difference is in the apocalypse, when the child is born, which would be the light, so to speak, in the apocalypse, the child that's born is in danger of being devoured by the dragon, so it's taken up into heaven, which means that that image can, the meaning of that image is not able to be understood, wasn't able to be understood at the time it was seen. Now, that is the same image as the light of the sun and the moon. Does that make sense to you? The apocalypse woman gives birth to a child. She's the sun-moon woman, like the sun-moon image in the house gives birth to light. In the one case, it's a child, in the second case, it's light. But it's the same idea, and that the first appearance of it in the book of Revelation shows that it was not able to be integrated. Its second appearance in Thomas's visions announces that it becomes the religious task of the time to, in a sense, give birth to that child and then bring it to earth. Does that make sense, or is that too much, too fast? The next image was that there was a house on a rock which was to be anointed with the blood of a billy goat, buck goat, so that waters can flow from the rock. Now, she called that an image of the unio corporalis. Do you want to review those stages, or can you spit it back to me? No, can't spit it back.
Nah, let's read it.
Okay. She is drawing from Jung's work on this, I believe he was German alchemist, Gerhard Dorn, who said that the process of union has three stages. First stage is a separation. I mean, it's a bit ironic that a stage of union is a separation, but this is within the process. The first stage is the unio mentalis, which means M-E-N-T-A-L-I-S. U-N-I-O, unio mentalis. It means one mind. And what that is a separation, in the alchemical model, is a separation of the elements. Very often the separation out of a gas from the material body. And Jung interprets that to be a metaphor for the first stage of understanding, where you get to understand what your problems are. And that would be like saying, oh, I get upset because when people criticize me because my father was critical. That would be such an insight. Already that's a step ahead, because the stage before that would be, no, I'm not upset. And I'm upset because you're such a jerk. And the first stage is realizing I'm upset because this is my issue. However, that doesn't mean you can control those emotions. It just means you have insight and you stop blaming. Still, you will get upset at criticism in a way that's not warranted in my hypothetical case. Because understanding is there, but it's not totally the ability to affect the power of that understanding hasn't been developed. That's the unio mentalis. So understanding begins to develop vis-a-vis the emotions. The unio corporalis is when you take that understanding and it can have an effect on what you're feeling at the moment of attack or of perceived attack. It's when the awareness penetrates back into the emotion and can make a difference in the way you feel. In the first case, the unio mentalis at the in its highest form, it can affect the way you behave, but you still might feel under attack. But you can say, this is my complex. I'm not going to argue back. I'm going to react differently than I feel. You see what I mean? I'm still feeling like I'm being attacked, like I'm being criticized, when all my partner has said is you're late, and I am late. The complex wants to start a fight, and I don't start a fight. I say, you're right, I'm late. But inside, I'm still activated. That would be the unio mentalis. Understanding has freed up from the emotions. When understanding can go back to the emotions and actually change the way you feel, that's the unio corporalis, the one body. So understanding has gone into the physical reality of your emotional experience. So you got separation and a reunion. And in the alchemical language, the spirit then would go back into that material that's being cooked, and it would turn into gold. Now, many alchemists just leave it there. Separate, unite, separate, unite, separate, unite. And really what we're looking at now in this chapter, see the blood of the goat going on the stone, is life being put back in the body, in the emotions, so that it's not just a cerebral understanding.
Now, can you explain that one more?
Thomas has had a vision of God, but it's just a mental vision. It's the unio mentalis version of the alchemical process. He understands these things, but he is nowhere near living them. And what the blood on the stone would be taking the life vitality and animating the physical reality of that perception, so that you live that perception. You add life to that perception. It's not just a thought, it's a lifestyle. Does that make sense? Now, he's never going to achieve that, but he has achieved a mental understanding. So, and as far as Jung's concerned, this would be the archetypal aspect. As soon as you understand something, the psyche starts preparing the next stage. And the stage after that, even though they haven't occurred. So we'll see all the imagery of the subsequent stages, even though he never gets there. But it's valuable for our purposes to notice how the psyche would follow up a understanding on one level with the next image, and then the next image, and ideally one would integrate those, one would bring blood to those, but that doesn't happen, of course. So what this image of the blood on the stone is saying is take that mental thought and add life power to it, life substance to it. The third stage, which we will also see in the next chapter particularly, is and I think here Dorn is either very unique or somewhat unique, that he thinks there's yet a third stage, and that is when that unified body is united with the world. Or, in other words, when that unified body produces the change not only in the vessel, but in the world. In our language, that would be a synchronicity. When your inner work sets the stage for the world to respond just in the way you need it. Remember that synchronicity I told you about Pegasus? Well, I was lecturing on that this weekend. My friend called me. While I was lecturing on it, that truck drove by again.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Did she know you were lecturing or anything?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
The truck didn't know I was lecturing.
Yeah.
Or maybe it did.
Yeah.
And she's told me something I had forgotten, which makes it even more beautiful. I wish I would have remembered the first time. Underneath Pegasus was written the following. 8 times I fall down, 9 times I get up.
Oh.
Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah.
9 times I get up. That's the unio. That's the unis mundus. That's the unis mundus.
On the second step, is there? I just have written down here: softened, absorbed, and not broken. Is that a part where?
Well, another sense is that when you, when you are moving to the stage of unio corporalis, you soften. Because just think of it: you have a negative parental complex. Somebody criticizes you. You feel towards somebody makes a legitimate request of you that you have been, say, you're late. You have been late. Nothing to do with you. I got unis mundus. And you say, you know, I don't have to please you, because that comment feels like a parental criticism, when in fact it's a reality-based criticism, and you are projecting your negative parental experience on that person. You begin to get insight. Oh yeah, I am late, and that is a problem, and I really have no, it's not fair to my partner to get upset when I'm getting true feedback. But when each time that experience happens, you still bristle inside. Can you see how it's that unio corporalis is a stiffness? Because you have the emotion, and your body is tense, but you say, but I'm not going to give way to it. The emotion doesn't go away, you just control it, but the operative word there is control. So you're really at war with your nature. And it is an uptight phase. People who are going through this are often kind of jumpy, because they're learning to control affects, but they're still not at peace with themselves, because the affect wants to do one thing and they want to do another. So it produces a kind of rigidity and brittleness. And when the unio corporalis stage is reached, that emotion actually changes. So you no longer feel the same way, and you soften. And then you're much more receptive to other instincts. I think that's what she's driving at. You're receptive to other instincts, and there's more of a flow to your life.
So that second, the unio corporalis, has two. Well, I started with the goat blood. I thought that was a third, and but it wasn't. Unis mundus was the third.
Oh, unis mundus is the third.
So the goat. All that stuff about adding life power to substance.
That's the unio corporalis, and that's the image of the goat's blood. That's why she gets into it here. Because she's saying, look, you see, we've had a unio mentalis, because remember how decimated he was with the flood and all the emotions that he was experiencing, and now he's gotten some stability. So there's been a unio mentalis. But he's beginning to become stable. He's beginning to understand, or he's beginning to have a new experience. I don't know if he's beginning to understand, but ideally it would get to that. But he's beginning to get a new experience, which he hasn't, however, in any way emotionally understood. And it has had no emotional effect on him. So that's why she says, look, the next image is blood on the stone. That's an image of the unio corporalis. It's trying to bring life back into the lifelessness of the body, of the understanding, of the rational, bring emotionality back into what has been a mental understanding.
He is moving into that.
He never does, but the
No. Oh my gosh. Okay.
No, because see, if he did, he'd have to start having sex. That's what it amounts to. He can understand that there's a new image of God around, but what the implications of that image is that physical life is sacred. The body is sacred. And there's no way he can accept that. So it remains a mental construct. And we will see then how the dreams try to move him past that. And they continue trying to move him past that, whether he gets it or not. So for our purposes, it's the same. But he never accomplishes it.
A lot of that's because of what he, I mean, at the time, I mean, consciousness wasn't ready, right?
Right. Consciousness wasn't ready, and he wasn't able.
I have a question. And they talk about the blood of the goat. And is that because it's the opposite of the blood of the lamb in the Bible? You know, the lambs are going to heaven and the goats are going
yes,
to hell.
Yes. She doesn't mention it, but that's a very good way to put it, I think. Okay. And I think just the goat, you know, the billy goat, he's a lascivious character.
But they're more intelligent. Aren't the goats more intelligent than lambs? I mean, sheep.
I think they are, yeah.
Aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, the goat goes back into the feminine, too, doesn't it? Represent more the, to me, the.
I mean, pardon my crudity, but the billy goat will hump anything.
Yeah.
And that's the point, I think.
Just the physical, I guess.
He is just lasciviousness. Yeah, just the animal indiscriminate desirousness. And, you know, he pees on his girlfriends. He's a nasty guy. That's how he marks his girlfriends. He pees on them.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Women were even chattel back then.
Yeah, he is. He is a nasty character.
So it feels very much like the mystery
stuff. It's definitely similar, where ironically that really negative image is brought in a positive way. Because with the billy goat would just be the instinct without the spirit. But he's got spirit without instinct. So if you can bring in that crude instinct, and I think probably the crudity of the image is very much intended here. If you can bring in the crudity, what happens when it meets spirit? It's not crude anymore. But that's not what he understands. And they also give sort of a, she quotes another alchemical text giving the spiritual dimension of the billy goat. But my sense is the real meaning here is his lasciviousness. So we're going to see the three stages of the conjunctio throughout. And so you might, if that's confusing, you might even want to make yourself a little separate page to remind you. So, because it's very important. And we'll see it coming back. And, you know, just my own personal little bias, I think this work of Jung's is laying the groundwork for a new understanding of how do you exist politically and socially in the world effectively, because there is a way to become centered so that that very process creates the gateway which comes, which the world brings to you to enter it. See what I'm saying? This is not giving to the world through morality, but giving to the world through the next stage of the process. And it seems to me it really, there's a lot of research to be done here in my field. How does this work? Of course, it's a relatively late phase of the work. As I said, most people, some people, not can't say most people, but a lot of people are happy just with the unio mentalis. That's AA. Just, you know, help me stop my destructive behavior. I don't care about being about flowing. I just want to stop destroying myself. So really, that is itself an enormous accomplishment very often. Some people want to go a step further, and once the behavior is changed, move into a softness and generosity and creativity within themselves that is a step beyond just behaving well. And that is already a late thing. Yes.
So is that saying that you have to stop the behavior before you can do the understanding part, or can you do the should you do the understanding part before it's stopped?
I don't think you can stop it until you understand.
So that's not what I heard you saying would happen in AA.
Well, they get an idea, you know, this behavior is harmful. They give them some level of understanding, and then that gives them the ability to stay dry.
And then the next point is...
Then often they'll come into union work, because that's all the farther AA goes.
Well, a lot of them, too, they blame the alcohol, so they haven't taken it into the body, saying that, you know what I mean, going into the center. That's what they kind of tell us. They kind of blame the alcohol for that they're out of control and they use that alcohol.
Is that true? I don't know if that's true.
But that was kind of when I was dealing with that, that was the evil thing. You know,
I just don't know. You might very well be right.
So that was part of it, you know.
But then how would you, in other addictive behavior, like with food, would you call the food evil?
No, I mean, you got to get past. It's just the surface. That's what you got to, that's the thing, taking the next step is looking beyond what that symptom is.
My sense of that is that you have to separate and say, I'm good, the alcohol's bad. And so you that sort of thing before you can move into another level.
And that would be the first blame.
Well, they're all different levels of unio mentalis.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's like saying, again, you got to put yourself in the position of a depraved individual who doesn't think they're harming anybody. If you can just get them to say the alcohol is bad, that may be an enormous accomplishment. That will at least stop them from coming home drunk and beating up their kids. Of course, we are attempting to go a little further, which would be to say there is something about me which cannot control myself around alcohol. I would still call that the unio mentalis. And you just think of the typical things that AA does. Oh, you know, helping you do a personal inventory, helping you examine the harm you've done, apologizing. That's all unio mentalis. That's all understanding what you've been doing. You have been harming other people. And that, no, they don't do a depth analysis necessarily, but still I would say that's a unio mentalis. Very often then, they're happy with that. Some people are not happy with that because they realize, I've stopped drinking. What have I started? And they'll come into analytic work, and then what we'll do, we will look at the causes of it from a depth psychological standpoint. Still, you know, your parental constellation, so on. Still unio mentalis. But eventually, it will move into not just stopping the behavior, but finding in those difficult emotions seeds of positive value, going back to them, freeing them up, and living them in some sort of creative and loving way. That would be the unio corporalis. It's a schema, but if you can take it as that, I think it's helpful.
You know, my best friend in the program now in California came into this program through AA, and here's what he would say about it. He would say his relationship to the alcohol was what was bad. He doesn't call the alcohol bad. He doesn't call...
Yeah.
Because he said one of the things, to look around and other people will have to drink, and it seemed to be a nice social thing, and some people...
Yeah.
So he saw that his relationship with the alcohol was bad.
Right.
So he got into AA to understand how he could break that relationship.
No, that's a positive.
No longer be in relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Then once he did that, one of two things happened. Either you adapt to the old cultural myth and you just go back to live a life without the alcohol and all of its attending dysfunction,
mm-hmm.
Or as he did, he looked at the myth and said, I can't go back there.
Mm-hmm.
all seems, you know, he's an investment banker, and he took the money, and he looked, and he said, this is all meaningless.
Mm-hmm.
So from then, he went on to now trying to understand mm-hmm. what new methods evolved.
That's Unio Corporales, so, right.
I mean, that was his path,
mm-hmm.
Which I think maybe might be an example of what you're talking
mm-hmm.
about.
Mm-hmm.
But and most people don't take the next step.
Most people in AA don't.
They're happy to be living in their family mm-hmm. and being able to get to work on time mm-hmm. and all of those things. They just sort of mm-hmm. adapting to mm-hmm. it as a
myth. And what was I going to say? Oh, the people you will find in Jungian psychology who have come from AA, I think are of that sort. So everyone you're going to meet here is looking for the Unio Corporalis, to put it in that way. But I would suspect they are among the lesser percentage of AA folks as a whole.
And what's a mundus? What would that be then?
Unus mundus is when you have achieved that integration and the outer world responds in a synchronicity.
And then you write a book on alcoholism? Or anything?
Well, like my friend, the Pegasus drives by and she feels the world is supporting her studies, where every voice in her has said no. You're wasting your time and money. Her parents said you're wasting your time and money. You're stupid. What are you doing this for? The world says, nine times you get up.
And my friend had a chance conversation with somebody about Joseph Campbell, who he knew nothing about, and he just moved to California through a whole set of synchronistic things, and all mm-hmm. of a sudden he's in the midst of what he thinks is miraculous work.
Mm-hmm.
And it was he attributes that moment that he had that conversation
yeah.
that just came out of nowhere.
That's the Unus Mundus.
So it was, and the next thing you know, he's at Pacifica helping him.
Right, that's Campbell's perfect example.
Books, and he's going, my God, you're
perfect, because the world then leads your process.
Right.
And the thing that interests me, coming out of the generation of hippies who've become yuppies, is that I think is the way then you contribute to the world in a genuine fashion. And as long as you do it out of a should, it eventually flips into its opposite. But if you can do it out of an is, that you watch how you grow, you watch how the world meets your growth, so that your friend's task in life might very well be to edit Joseph Campbell. Because that's how the tasks announce themselves. They don't only just announce themselves from the inside. They literally announce themselves from the outside.
Actually, his task as an oil banker
mm-hmm.
is to go back and help people come into better relationships mm-hmm. with their resources.
Mm-hmm.
That's
yeah.
what he's in this for.
And he'll, if it's genuine, he'll see that synchronicities help him do that.
Oh, he totally gets that. Mm-hmm. In fact, now the point is to try to stay conscious to them,
mm-hmm.
to pay attention,
that's
and
the,
so he can move with them.
That's the challenge of the third stage, to realize that the synchronicity is as much a directive as is a dream. And it's amazing where people will tell me a synchronicity, and they'll tell it like they've just, like they're telling me what the price of gas is. And I just have to jump up and down and scream and yell and say, no, 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 this is a dream. This is just as important as a dream. Follow this up. Return that phone call. For Christ's sake, return that phone call. You don't realize that the outer world is as symbolic as the inner world. But that, to me, is one of the implications of the Sophia material. If the psyche is not just on the inside. You don't really... Again, we're describing it linearly. It's not quite so black and white. But I think over time you do see these phases. And in the phase described as the Unus Mundus, you've got the outer world leading you and providing the point of entry for all those talents and all that honesty and all that integrity that you've developed up to now. Then the door opens from the world and says, here... Now, you can put it all here. And you can't force that. You can read the one ads, and actually I tell people to do that, but what actually happens, what actually makes the final step is something meets you.
What?
Something meets you.
Something meets you.
Something comes to you.
You know, and I think it's also little things, too. I mean, sometimes it's those big moments.
Yes, it's definitely little things.
I was struggling. I'm working on a paper for a movie, and I chose the hours, and I was struggling with it. I thought,
mm-hmm.
okay, I don't think this is what I'm supposed to be doing, but it didn't. I wasn't sure, and so I was just, I, so I asked, I said, helped me to know. Mm-hmm. So my husband called and said, "Will you pick up something from me on the way home at Blockbuster?" I mm-hmm. walked in, and guess what movie was playing on the screen? The Hours.
Yeah, that's it.
That's an old movie. Mm-hmm. Why would they have that movie?
Mm-hmm. That's exactly it.
And this, you know, this was last
so that is your paper.
So it's my paper.
Yeah.
I'm hanging in there with it,
yeah.
even though it's hard, but that's the word I have to do. And it felt, it was like, okay, I can do this.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. That's classic, 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 classic.
And it feels so good.
It feels so good.
It's hard to do the work, yeah. Just know you're in the right place.
Because, when you go the individual path, all the voices in the side you and probably outside you say you are making a mistake. Mm-hmm. And you need that response from the universe to say, no, you're not. And absolutely. I describe big synchronicities, but in the work, I think it's part of the therapist's job to feel sometimes these things are very subtle. Like going with your husband's request to pick up a movie. You see, that was in your service, not his. And often these things creep in teensy little ways. A kid coming to the door and wanting to buy their garbage bags for North Central Arts Program or something, and then something comes out of that conversation. You can kind of tell in the dreams when these experiences are more likely to happen. Sometimes they don't, and then sometimes they do. There are different phases. Very much, yeah.
How can you tell?
Well, you see, in a case like this, you've got the unio corporalis image, so he's probably not at that point yet. But we'll see imagery of the unio, of the unis mundus. That's what the imagery would tell you. Yeah. Dreams of clocks. References to time. See, this is a time phenomenon. At a certain moment in time, a synchronicity happens. So they're sometimes... an indicator. Why are you smiling? Oh, I thought so.
I'm like, okay, we are cooking here.
But think of it. Think of the odds of in Los Angeles of 20 million people, the same freaking truck driving by at the same time. I'm discussing it. It's just unbelievable. I think that's where we left off. To sum up, what she says is that the visions we've had of the union, the sun, the house, they have been intuitive visions. So it's a union mentalis. The other thing then she does, which we went through quite quickly, was just the virtues necessary to pull this process off. In a way, that's common sense, but maybe not today with our, what do I call it, our cynical pop culture, screw your neighbor mentality. This isn't going to work if you're not moral. It presupposes morality. And if you're not an unethical person, forget it. It will not happen. I think that's the point of all that. Okay, that took us over to 337.
Would you say not too much? I'm going to go call about a coffee.
Oh, okay. We'll have a...
We'll stop the time.
We can just talk about stuff until she...
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Because what you just said there at the end, you said you have to be ethical to do this work.
Yeah.
I mean, my sense is that the universe is amoral and doesn't really care how you use it.
Does care.
And that people can use this in a synchronistic fashion to do things that aren't... I mean, you can use synchronicity...
Oh, yeah.
...to do things that are not in the best interest.
Oh, definitely. But you can't reach selfhood if you're not ethical.
Okay. So you're talking about the individual.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Ethics, they should ask you that.
Mm-hmm.
They take advantage of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
their intuitive ability and worship practice.
Well, doesn't von Franz make a distinction between a synchronicity that comes from a complex and one that comes from the self?
He might.
But would some alchemists have, or someone, was it Camarios or someone, made the distinction when she talks about it?
If you can find that, let me know. Speaking of finding things, I found your question. Marcosians?
Yeah.
And Marcos, no connection. Marcos is a Marcos, this is a Mysterium. I'll give you this. Is probably identical with Marcus Graecus, author of the so-called Book of Fire. He is difficult to date.
Now she's talking about Marcus.
Marcus. The fact is that he is mentioned by Senior, who may date him before the 10th century. And Marcosians are Gnostics. So
there's no connection.
There's no connection.
Oh, thank you.
We didn't say anything important. Are they going to bring us a coffee?
No.
All right. Thought maybe we were getting demoted or something.
Well, I did too. She tried to talk me out of it.
Well, tell them I'll deduct a dollar from the rent.
Deduct $8, isn't that what they charged? Were going to charge us before? $8.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, right. Right. Okay, I'll watch my tongue when they get here. That's 337. I guess what we'll do is just sum up the chapter on 338. I'll just read the whole thing. I'll go sentence by sentence. If you get confused, or if it doesn't make sense, stop. If you don't stop me, I'll keep going. This is really a summary of what we've done up to now, period. 338. In conclusion, we can sum up as follows. In the opening chapters, there is manifest... a tremendous tension of opposites, accompanied by an almost deliriously excited manner of speaking. The mood alternates between ecstatic joy and profound despair. Now the ego seems caught in an inflation, now utterly dissolved. The anima wisdom appears contaminated with shadow elements, black earth, Ethiopians, corrupting humidity, etc. And behind her looms up, the dark, vindictive, destructive side of God. Not until the fourth parable is reached does the author succeed, with the help of the reconciling function of the unconscious, in building up a spiritual standpoint and gaining a spiritual understanding of what is going on within him. So that would be the Holy Spirit chapter. The opposites no longer alternate, but begin to influence one another reciprocally, and this assists in the reconciliation or union in the unconscious. The union of irreconcilables is experienced in the present parable as a visionary reality and is revealed in the form of an authentic God image, that's the house. The vision of the Hieros Gamos, that's the sun and the moon, in the treasure house of wisdom seems temporarily at least to have gripped the author's feelings. For whereas in the preceding parable an attempt was made to integrate the eruption of unconscious contents into a spiritual hierarchy, that was the bit about this is really the Holy Spirit. The present parable goes on to describe the author's emotional and moral confrontation with these inner events. The predominance of feeling is reflected in the reappearance of the anima in the figure of wisdom as contrasted with the Holy Spirit in the preceding parable. The lapis as treasure house is now represented primarily as the sum of man's moral qualities, the didactic allegorical style, and the disappearance of the poetic element being particularly striking. One would hardly expect this after so momentous a vision. Obviously, the content of the vision has been grasped only intuitively, and closer contact with the experience is still lacking. Nevertheless, the vision seems to have had a calming effect on the author, which caused him to be mindful of his own attitude and of his situation as a human being. This sense of calm and reassurance was no doubt due very largely to the feeling of immortality which the vision gave him. Summary, and hopefully makes sense.
So he had the experience but missed the meaning.
He had the experience but missed the meaning. Well said.
church.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you ready to move on? I had a heck of a time figuring this thing out, and I'm still not sure I've got it completely right, so don't. Maybe we can work together on this. The symbolism is the symbolism of the earth. And where did I find that? When I'm confronted with a confusing chapter like this, what I try to do is go through it and find one sentence that makes sense. And that may, in a way, summarize the meaning of the chapter. In other words, what's the main idea of the chapter? Start with that. That's what I try to do. I think I found the main idea on page 340. The last sentence before the quote. Therefore, the author tries in the present chapter to describe this totality of ultimate reality, which is the substrate of his experience. Now, what's that mean? This is how I'm going to try to phrase it, and I think I'm okay, but if I'm wrong, we'll have to reevaluate. But he's had this experience, this picture, this vision of the self, the house, right, and the sun and the moon. And what he's saying is, that is basic. That's the ground of my experience. That's why the earth comes in. So wait till he gets... here he comes. However, in the chapter, she says about 20 different things are this ground, which I'll mention to you in a minute. Thank you. And I notice that she acknowledges that on page 347. She says, this thing is described as one thing, last line from the bottom, and also, paradoxically, also. So what's so confusing here is that this ground is described as many different things. It's not just one thing. And on page 354, she says, the first paragraph after the quote, the earth is one thing, and yet it is at the same time.
Where are you?
The on page 354, after the quote, after the textual quote, go down one, two, three lines after the line starting here, the mysterious end product. Everybody see that? Now go down three lines. Yet it is at the same time. Or yet it is the same. So you see, she is saying that this thing is many things. I think that's why the chapter is so confusing.
She's saying what?
That the earth is many different things. I'm just trying to justify my method because I'm thinking if she can say that, so can I.
Don't you almost think that's the reason for the chapter?
Yes, I do. It took me a while to figure that out. Exactly. That is the reason for this chapter. And here, using that, what Karin just said as a sort of takeoff point, what I think that what this chapter is about, it's saying, oh, I just had a fundamental ground of an experience, a fundamental basis of an experience. So in that sense, that experience is earth. This experience is my standing point. This is my earth. But then he goes to different aspects of that experience and says, and that is earth, and that is earth, and that is earth, and that is earth. It's sort of like at each phase of the process, he's saying, oh, this is the fundamental part of it. And then, oops, oh no, this is the fundamental part of it. And then, oops, oh no, this is the fundamental part of it.
Does that get right to the idea of the unus mundus?
Well, he says unus mundus is one of the fundamental parts, but he also says the unio corporalis is one of the fundamental parts. And I wrote them out. The unus mundus, wisdom, the unconscious. We'll go through these. The mystery, prima materia, the unio corporalis, God, human beings. He says the earth is all those things. And I'm thinking, what in the world are you talking about? But I think what he's doing, he's saying they are all features of this experience. And when you're in that dimension of the experience, you think this is the basic thing. This is the basic thing. This is the basic thing. And it is for that moment. Yeah. So that has helped me make sense of the chapter. Now, I'm not totally sure I'm on track, but that's how I'm going to present it. The chapter is on the earth, and the earth is said to symbolize about 8 or 9 different things. And the reason that is valid is because at that point of the process, each of those parts seems like the most important thing.
I guess my thinking was that speaks to one of her definitions of unus mundus, which is it's the substrate or the ground common to consciousness and the unconscious, so that it's the unity beyond existence.
Yeah, or these are all components of the unity beyond existence.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, since they're all part of the ground, they are also ground.
Mm-hmm.
That might be a way to put it. I just found it it's been pretty linear. For Jungians up to now, but I thought this one really taxed my linear, my symbolic mind, because basically what she's saying is everything is everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those things.
Gary, could you think about it too? That if you think about it, the earth came out of chaos.
Mm-hmm.
And chaos, what happened was a differentiation process.
Mm-hmm.
And things began to differentiate from the other. So they're just naming these various things that came out of that chaos.
Right.
Every time you're in the presence of another one, you have a sense that this is the order you're looking for.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So, and you know in your process that happens.
Yeah.
Things just go crazy, and all of a sudden something happens here, and something happens over here that feels completely disconnected from the other. And it's a differentiation process.
Yeah, and the other thing I think I'd add to that is that remember we were dealing with an intuitive vision. We were dealing with an intuitive vision, and what was lacking in that intuitive vision was the earth. In other words, how it realistically was to make life different. And my sense is that part of the meaning of the earth in this chapter is for each dimension of the experience, the fact that it has not been realized is in his unconscious mind. And so each of these is described as earth, meaning each of these has to be made real. That's another way to look at it.
Each of these, and what was the...
Well, I made a list of what she says the earth is. First she says the earth is the unus mundus. Then she says the earth is wisdom. Then she says the earth is the unconscious. And I'll follow these through for you. Earth is the mystery. Earth is the prima materia. Earth is the unio mentalis. Earth is God. Earth is the human being. And that took me to 3:53 and I was tired.
Mystery, prima materia, what was next?
I'll read through them again. Unus mundus. Wisdom, unconscious, mystery, prima materia, unio corporalis, God, human beings. She says, Earth is all of those things. No. Unus mundus, wisdom, unconscious, mystery, prima materia, unio corporalis.
Corporalis.
I might have even read it wrong. Who knows? Unio corporalis. God. Human beings. That's up to 353, where I give up for today. Maybe more. But since I'm thinking, is it just me? And then I see her say on 347 that it is also this, and then I see her saying on 354, it is the same. Then I realize, oh, she is working with multiple levels of meaning too. So I don't think we're too far off. So when I get confused, I look for the main idea. And then I try to check that idea through the text and then see, can I substantiate or contradict my assumption? And I think I'm okay. This is hard for me too, believe me. So we have a stretch.